Penny White is one of my colleagues at the University of Tennessee College of Law, where I've been teaching for the last 5 or 6 summers. She is a delightful woman and a much-loved law professor, but in her former life, she used to be a justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court. Now, I knew the broad outlines of her career, and I knew that she had been non-retained on the Tennessee Supreme Court. I'd always wondered a little bit about that, and I wondered especially since I've been talking to a number of other judges and justices over the past few months. And recently when I heard that there's a great controversy over the retention of some of the current sitting justices on the Tennessee Supreme Court, I could think of no one better than Penny to ask about this process and about her own personal story. I think you'll agree it's fascinating. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today it's the non-retention of Justice Penny White.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Lately, I've been examining that often overlooked third branch of government, the judiciary, and I've interviewed a federal judge and state judge, a state Supreme Court justice, actually a couple of them, most recently the Chief Justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court, a gentleman by the name of Gary Wade. Now, he and I had a very pleasant conversation, and we talked about how he'd become a Chief Justice and his career before then and all the rest of it. And then toward the end of the interview, I learned something. I learned that he was up for re-election, and that's not all that unusual. It's something called a retention election, where he faces no opponent. He simply goes before the public, and the public is given the chance either to retain him in his seat or not. What was unusual about this was that apparently there is organized opposition to his retention. Well, I asked him, well, what's the problem? What have you done? And he said, well, he really didn't know, but perhaps I should ask the person who was organizing this opposition. And it turns out that that person is the lieutenant governor of Tennessee. His name is Ron Ramsey. I've tried to contact Lieutenant Governor Ramsey on several occasions. I've sent him multiple emails. I've had my scheduler call his office multiple times. I've yet to hear back from him, and I'm very disappointed about that. And hey, Lieutenant Governor, if you want to come on the show sometime, you know where to find me. But failing that effort, I thought and thought, and I asked myself, now, who else do I know who's an expert on judicial retention elections in Tennessee? And then it struck me. I have a colleague and friend at the University of Tennessee College of Law. Her name is Penny White. And in her previous life, she was not only on the Tennessee Supreme Court, she's the only sitting justice in Tennessee history to be non-retained.
4 months before the retention race, the Tennessee Supreme Court issued a decision called State versus Odom, a capital case in which the defendant had challenged the constitutionality of Tennessee's death penalty, as well as raising numerous other issues. Our court denied relief on that issue. In other words, our court upheld the death penalty in the state of Tennessee. But 3 of us found an evidentiary error in the sentencing hearing. Don't want to get in the weeds, but in a capital sentencing hearing, the U.S. Supreme Court has said anything that's in mitigation is admissible or should be allowed into evidence. And 5 of us had found that the trial judge had failed to let some evidence in that he should have. To make it straightforward, the jury was entitled to know this aspect of the defendant's life before they decided whether they wanted to vote for death or vote for life.
So this guy's accused of a heinous crime. He's adjudged guilty of it. And then he's got to be sentenced. Mm-hmm. And then the jury typically has some options there. You can life without parole, that sort of thing, or it's something less, or ultimately the ultimate penalty is going to be death. Mm-hmm. And so what you're saying is that during that sentencing phase, the law of Tennessee is that you've got to let basically anything in there that might incline the jury to show mercy to on this defendant. And not
that's federal law.
That's federal law.
Okay, dictated
so it's constitutional law. So before you're going to actually put the ultimate penalty, you've got to give this guy basically every single chance to bring in any scrap of anything that can explain or mitigate or ameliorate what he's done in this case. Is that mm-hmm. a fair statement? Mm-hmm. And you all decided that in this particular case, while the death penalty itself was constitutional, there was an error in this case regarding some piece of evidence.
That's right. So five of us decided that the judge should have let in a psychiatrist's testimony. However, two of the justices said, even though the judge made an error, it didn't hurt anything. So in legal jargon, it was harmless. Three of us said, oh, yes, it did. This is a capital case. It was not harmless. You need to go back and have a new sentencing only. He still stands convicted of capital murder. He still stands qualified to die. But go back and have a hearing and let all the evidence in and get the jury to decide again. It's funny that you mentioned the word heinous crime, because that was the other issue in the case, whether the state had proven the heinousness of the crime. And three of us, again, as opposed to the entire five, concluded that the heinousness had not been established beyond a reasonable doubt, which the law required. And therefore, at the new sentencing, the state needed to buck up their evidence of heinousness.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about that, because that's very important. Not every murder is a capital murder. In fact, there are all sorts of ways that are all crimes that one person might kill another, but there are degrees of culpability. Imagine me, you know, losing my temper in a fight and hitting somebody a little bit too hard. Right. Okay, that's terrible, and it's horrible, and I should be punished for it. But it's not as if I planned it. It's not as if I tortured somebody. It's not as if I went out and harmed a child. All of those sorts of things would make it rise on the spectrum, and eventually we would come to some point where the court would conclude, yes, that's heinous enough to put me to death. Okay, is that a fair statement?
Somewhat, without getting too much into it. In every state, there are aggravating circumstances after you find that someone has committed a capital crime, that you must find at least one aggravating circumstance, and you must find that those outweigh everything in mitigation, or that circumstance outweighs everything in mitigation to end up with death. So one aggravating circumstance in Tennessee was at the time called that the murder was particularly heinous, atrocious, and cruel. And heinous, atrocious, and cruel was actually defined by the legislature. And it was defined to mean that the act was more than necessary to cause death and intended to inflict exceptional pain. Mm. So you're right. One gunshot wound wouldn't be heinous, atrocious, and cruel, but multiple stab wounds might. So our point in the case was, just because of the limited amount of proof that the state put on about the method of killing, they needed to do more to rely on that aggravating circumstance. Now, there are 14 aggravating circumstances in the law, so they may have had others. But basically, from our point of view, that one could not stick. They needed to try harder. All right, so all that...
Oh, wait a second. We can't go on. Now I'm really curious.
Sorry,
I'm curious.
I should have given a general description of why I wasn't retained.
No, this is all ultimately relevant. What actually had this fellow done, and what was the missing evidence?
The proof was that he had accosted an elderly woman in a parking garage as she returned from a doctor's appointment, had raped her, and had stabbed her to death. The missing proof was the degree of stab, the amount of stab wounds, the type of stab wounds, and how quickly death would have ensued. So, to make an example, I think the testimony was that there was a stab wound in the area of the lung, liver, and heart. Now, I'm going back almost 20 years with this memory here, but something like that. So the point of view of the judge who wrote the opinion, with whom I agreed, was that the pathologist would needed to have detailed more about the location of the stab wounds and more about what the likely result of such a stab wound was. So, example, if I stab you in the wrist, you may bleed a little bit and it may hurt, but would that be sufficient enough to satisfy that definition of heinous, atrocious, and cruel? In one way of looking at it, we were applying a strict adherence to the definition of heinous, atrocious, and cruel. But you have to consider, again, nothing simple, that the United States Supreme Court and other courts across the country had said that those words in and of themselves, heinous, atrocious, and cruel, are so ambiguous that they can't really narrow the class of culpable defendants sufficiently. The whole theory behind capital punishment as dictated by the U.S. Supreme Court in this country, is that we narrow down murderers until we get what is known as the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. So in this case, there was no question this man had killed this woman. There was no question he had raped her. There was proof of that. The question was, what was the method and manner of death? And was it sufficient to constitute heinous, atrocious, and cruel? Did it equal what the legislature said heinous, atrocious, and cruel meant beyond a reasonable doubt? Because that was the standard in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So by telling the state, no, three of us don't think you rose to that level, what we were really doing is saying, when you go back and retry this sentencing that you're going to have to retry because you didn't let the psychiatrist testify, make sure you buck up this proof a little. I mean, in some ways, all appellate opinions are instructions not only to the general audience of lawyers, but to the parties, especially mm-hmm. if something's going to be retried. So this was an instruction to the prosecution. If you're going to try to get a death sentence based on this aggravating circumstance, put in more proof. It was also an instruction to the defense lawyers, this is not enough. Be aware. So let's adjudicate the case with these rules.
In a strange way, you were helping out the prosecution then.
In a strange way, we were. But I think this conversation is so important because you and I are both lawyers. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty well informed about this area of the law. And it's taken us, what, 10, 12 minutes
just to figure it out.
So what happened is that many months after that decision, the opening headline in the attack against me read, court thinks murder rape of elderly virgin not cruel. TCU begins Just Say No campaign on Justice White. And that's almost verbatim. Mm. So 6 weeks before the election, several months after this Odom decision comes out, the, at that time, Nashville Banner ran the first Just Say No article against me, utilizing the Odom case as the reason to remove me as a justice. And there are lots of layers of that. First off, why me? Because I was the only one on the ballot. I did not write the Odom decision. I had never sat on another capital.
What was the vote in Odom?
3-2.
3-2.
3-2
okay.
On that issue, as,
3-2
as
on
said.
That, excuse me, on that particular
right.
issue. Okay, so you were one of three justices
the Chief
who was
Justice,
on that.
Right. The Chief Justice wrote the decision. Now, I'm not backing away from it. It was a correct decision.
No, that's all perfectly okay. But what I'm going to say here is that for the first time, timing didn't work out to your advantage.
Right.
I mean, up till now, you'd been the golden girl, and you had been just climbing each rung of the ladder with remarkable rapidity in the early 90s. And then arguably, your timing, if you'd just been off by another year or two, everything would have been fine. But you were the first one to come up under this brand new system, so you're going to get a lot more attention, I'm guessing, than has happened in a number of subsequent elections, and then just a few months after this very controversial case.
Yes and no. There's a lot of that that's true. There are some other interesting factors.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my friend and colleague, Professor Penny White of the University of Tennessee College of Law. In a previous life, Penny was a justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court. But then after a judicial career that had been marked by excellent timing and a meteoric rise, she found herself confronting circumstances beyond her control, and her timing, it seems, was very off. After the break, we'll continue this fascinating discussion with my friend and colleague, Penny White. Stick around.
My boy, the papers have a name for it. It's politics. Yes, it's politics. Filthy politics. If you can treat the general public like a bunch of hicks, you're in politics. What the heck? You spell it P-O-L-I-T-I-C-S. That's politics. What the heck?
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a fascinating discussion with my friend and colleague, Penny White, who teaches with me at the University of Tennessee College of Law. And Penny, it turns out, about 20 years ago, became the only justice in the history of the Tennessee Supreme Court to be non-retained, that is, to not be reelected when she was up for reelection. And that, of course, seems like a very timely thing to me because right now, as I prepare this program, there is a similar retention election that's scheduled very soon for the Tennessee Supreme Court. And it turns out there's a great deal of controversy. And just as 20 years ago with Penny White, there is organized opposition for not just one sitting justice, but for three sitting justices, including the Chief Justice. So I could think of no one better than Penny, no one with a better perspective on this retention process. And Penny, despite this being a rather unpleasant subject for her, agreed to sit down with me and tell me all about it. And it turns out that one of the factors that played against her reelection was her role in a very controversial death penalty case.
The timing of the decision, I think, speaks legions. We not only were not worried about issuing that decision that close to an election, when we learned that a Just Say No campaign against me had begun, we did not know why. We were completely oblivious that that case would cause any outcry. That's very, very important. It's important because that's what people need to expect of their courts. They need to expect judges who are not, as Governor Don Sunquist was famous for saying, looking over their shoulder to the next election. So what had happened between my appointment and, as you say, my meteoric rise and that May was that Governor McWhorter had termed out. He was no longer governor. We had a new governor. We had a new governor who looked at a Supreme Court, and all of this is hindsight. This was not obvious to the voting public or even to me at the time. But we had a new governor who looked at the Supreme Court and saw five people who got there either by nomination of the Democratic Party or by appointment by a Democratic governor. And he wanted his own person on that court. The way to get his own person was to pick off the only person who was going to come up for retention during his first term of governorship. And that happened to be me. So you're right. My timing was not good.
Not good in that regard, no.
But you don't pick off the only woman on the Supreme Court, one of two female appellate judges, by going after her on her merits. You pick her off by, and this is true nationwide, you pick any judge off by motivating, by placing fear in the hearts of the voters. And the quickest way to place fear in the heart of a voter is to make them think that some crazy person in a black robe is making their world less safe. And that was exactly what Governor Sunquist and his party and his friends and other people who weren't necessarily even politically connected jumped on the bandwagon to do, to make the voters be afraid of me. And the method was simple. In fact, this is the ad that they ran and the postcard that they sent out to many, 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 many people, especially senior citizens, including my father. If you favor capital punishment, vote against Penny White. So the image was created that I was standing between Tennesseans and the death penalty. At that point in 96, Tennessee had not executed anyone since Furman v. Georgia, a 1960s decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. We were wedged between capital punishment activist states, Virginia, Florida, Texas, and we weren't killing anybody. We had over 100 people on death row. The public couldn't understand that. So it was easy to suggest that I was the wedge. It worked. The public believed that if they voted against me, if they got me off the Supreme Court, they would begin to see executions. However, as I said, this is the first capital case, the only capital case I ever ruled on as a judge. And then just to take up on one other thing you said, the significance of it being the first retention race, that unfortunately did not play out in that way. There was an 18% voter turnout in August 1996, at which 52% of the voters just said no. So I used to know the exact number of people in the state who voted against me.
It was a tiny number.
A tiny number, mm-hmm. but enough. Enough. So that's very instructive for people who think that judges have to be elected. You can get rid of a judge in a retention state, and I'm living proof.
Well, that sounds like one heck of an experience.
It was pretty horrific.
And I echo your assessment. I mean, this is a fairly complicated area of the law, an extremely important one, the death penalty. Mm-hmm. The issue is not whether Tennessee is going to have it or not, but whether what they have is going to comply with the U.S. Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And if I understood you correctly, that's what you all were trying to do, was to make sure that whatever happened was going to pass constitutional muster. And it took us, as you said, 10 minutes to get through all the analysis, but it was reduced to Penny White is against the death penalty, which is inaccurate.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I guess I should say it was inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
My post-judicial career has led me to have different opinions about a number of subjects than I had at the time I was on the bench.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But at the time, it was an inaccurate statement. It was, at the very least, a great simplification. And I guess that's one of the arguments that people might have against judicial elections of any sort, is that judges are supposed to rule on some very complex areas of law. And one kind of wonders whether that is something that the democratic process should be implemented in. I mean, I don't know. How do you feel about judicial elections generally?
Mm, I'm against them.
Yeah, for that reason?
At the trial level, I'm not so much against them. And I feel like I have a disciplined reason for differentiating between trial and appellate judges. But at the Supreme Court level, I don't favor judicial elections. It's even more complicated now with the money issues. Money was not really an issue in my campaign. There was a lot. There were, I would have to say, hundreds of negative newspaper articles. There were lots of people in the streets, literally, holding press conferences against me. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a huge amount of television advertising like there is in modern-day judicial elections.
You know, it's just I've not spent as much time thinking about this, perhaps, as I should, but in a way, doctors and lawyers are very similar, and that is that we're both professionals and we each have very complex jobs that require years and years of education and training, certainly before we ever get to the point of being judges as lawyers. So in a sense, electing a judge is sort of like electing a doctor.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just not anyone can do it. I mean, you have to study a long time before you can get there. And moreover, I, as a voter, do I really want to select a doctor on the basis of a slogan or an electoral campaign, or would I rather have some sort of merit retention? And I'm just thinking out loud here. That would be an argument. Of course, the counterargument is that judges are part of the government, and so maybe they should be, but maybe they're a special part of the government. Maybe they shouldn't be elected.
I agree with your analogy, especially in this regard. If I'm going to choose a doctor, I want to know where he went to school, how he did, how she did,
mm-hmm.
what types of procedures she's been specializing in, where she's worked, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think a voter should want to know those same things about judicial candidates, not whether they put an elephant or a donkey on a bumper sticker, or whether they have a stance on crime and punishment or abortion. And what we find happening in judicial races, especially as a result of some other decisions by the United States Supreme Court, is that candidates are often aligned with social policy issues that are never going to come before that court.
Right.
But they are aligned in a way that misleads the public into believing that a judge will rule in accord with some sort of political philosophy that matches theirs. So my point is that sometimes it gives the voter an unrealistic expectation of what a judge can or will really do on the bench by thinking, well, this judge is a Republican, or this judge is a Democrat, or this judge was supported by this group that's against this or for that. It's almost like they expect the judge will rule in accord with that. That would only be the worst kind of judge, who ruled in accord with a personal belief when that personal belief was inconsistent with the rule of law.
Yep.
Easy example. We have a lot of good Catholic judges, and their personal belief would prohibit them from being divorced. But divorce is legal in 50 states, and those judges are going to have to grant divorces if they want to be a judge in those 50 states.
About 20 years ago, I ran for a local political office and county commission, and I kept getting asked about my position on abortion. And I kept trying to explain, look, the county commission does things like trash pickup. Okay, we don't really have anything to say about that, and yet people were very insistent. Okay, so I understand what you're saying. Well, it's a perennial problem, and you've already alluded to the exacerbation of that problem. I think it was in 2002 that the Supreme Court decided a very important case, Republican Party versus White, up in Minnesota, mm-hmm. that involved judicial races. Now, just a little bit of background, you jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but by and large, most states regulate judges and they regulate judicial elections, or at least they did. Mm-hmm. And they said judges are not supposed to express opinions on things that they might rule on. They're not supposed to take positions on matters that may come before the court that they're trying to do. They've got to maintain decorum. They've got all sorts of requirements that are essentially designed to prevent judges from prejudging cases. You know, if you couldn't get up there and say, I'm going to hang and judge, and so anybody who comes in front of me and is a murderer, I'm going to hang them. Well, that might get you some votes, but then if you actually do get elected and someone comes up in front of you, it presents a real question about whether that person's getting an impartial tribunal and due process. And there are codes of judicial canons that tell judges they're not supposed to say these things, whether during elections or while they're on the bench. And that had been the general rule. So judicial elections, I'm sure even including yours, tended to be relatively tame affairs in that regard. And there was a lot that judges really couldn't say, and they didn't say. But that was all challenged on the basis of the First Amendment, because judges, like anyone else, have First Amendment rights to express themselves. And the issues and the questions are being asked during judicial elections are what we call core political speech, mm-hmm. the most highly protected type of speech. And the Republican Party challenged the prohibitions on those sorts of speech up in Minnesota. And they also, well, basically they won. And most of the restrictions on judicial speech were lifted at that time, or put in very serious doubt across the nation. And so judges started talking a lot more, didn't they, after that point?
Right.
Or judicial candidates.
Yeah, excellent description of the case. Two additional points. The Supreme Court decision in White, Republican Party versus White, was very narrow. But what it did was prompt states to sort of dismantle, but they did not dismantle universally. So now there are different restrictions in different states. And I think the other aspect that's so important is, yes, some candidates began speaking much more freely in order to be identified with these groups, certain groups, and often these groups have money to help support their candidacy. Some judges choose not to speak, and at least not to speak about those kinds of issues, but to try to go back and tell the public their qualifications. You know, I'm completely biased on this issue, but my point of view is that's who you want for your judge. You want a judge who wants to talk to you about qualifications for the bench, not about political issues.
But before 2002, judges, in a sense, could get away with that. If I was a judicial candidate and someone asked me all sorts of loaded questions, and, you know, how are you going to rule on abortion cases or something, I could say, look, I can't answer that question, but I'm happy to tell you that right. I've served on the bench this many years, and I went to this law school, and I've done this, this, and this. Now a judge who tries to do that is confronted with an opposing candidate, perhaps, that is more than willing to get up there and say, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, and I'll tell you how I'm going to rule on those sorts of cases, or maybe not quite that far, but it's going to get some definite hints
right.
about which philosophy that judge has. And so that sort of pressures even those more reticent judicial candidates into doing the same thing. And as you point out, there are lots of groups out there who are ready to give money to judges or judicial candidates who are willing to say what those groups like.
Right, who align with their way of thinking. And even judges who don't campaign openly receive questionnaires mm-hmm. asking them to state their views. And then very often the results of the questionnaires will be posted in an advertisement paid for by the group, not by a candidate. Mm-hmm. And for the judge who doesn't respond, there'll be, you know, big capital letters, refuse to respond. So it's a very difficult tightrope for a judge who wants to uphold the integrity of the bench and to depoliticize the judiciary to walk.
And as you pointed out, judges now who are incumbents, who might be up for retention, are now looking over their shoulders. I mean, judges are human beings. Judges need income. Judges want, most of them probably want to retain their judgeships. On the other hand, that's always been a concern with anybody who doesn't have life tenure in the federal system, with most state judges. Now perhaps that concern, or at least the pressures that are on incumbent judges, are greater.
I agree with your assessment. They're much greater. I still hold the opinion that most judges don't look over their shoulder. I'm naive in some ways, but I have a wonderful opportunity to teach judges at the National Judicial College and to meet judges from all over the country. And for the most part, they're men and women of the highest degree of integrity, and they fight the urge to think about the impact of their decision. But they are human.
You could even go through a mental process of saying, well, if I just decide this one case this way, then at least I'll get back on, and then I can do all sorts of good things in my next term, right? I mean, that's the way people would rationalize mm-hmm. that kind of behavior.
It's completely sensible. You know, and we have to add to this pressure, the pressure that was added to it by the U.S. Supreme Court, two, three terms back, money. Because now not only can special interest groups sort of require judges to answer, I mean, make it difficult for judges not to answer, they can also spend limitless amounts
of
money.
Yeah, a lot of campaign. Yeah, the Citizens United decision and that line of decisions out there, there's much more money out there. And we've seen some pretty stark examples of that, I think, in West Virginia, especially a couple of years back, where a decision of the West Virginia Supreme Court was actually reversed by the United States Supreme Court because of the appearance of impropriety in that circumstance, where it looked as if one of the litigants had essentially bought himself the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who then decided in that litigant's favor. There have been other poignant stories. I think we interviewed former Justice Oliver Diaz of Mississippi, who had was targeted not by so much an interest group in that case, but what he considered to be a political opponent.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my friend and colleague, Penny White, from the University of Tennessee College of Law, about her former career as a justice on the Tennessee Supreme Court, where she has the unhappy distinction of being the only justice in the history of that court to be non-retained, that is, to be defeated at her re-election. And it turns out that 20-year-old story has a lot of current resonance because a similar attempt to unseat several sitting justices of the Tennessee Supreme Court is currently underway. After the break, we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion with Penny White, and it's a good one, so stick around. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish my discussion with my colleague at the University of Tennessee Law School, Penny White, who is a former Supreme Court justice in the state of Tennessee. And before the break, Penny and I were discussing the increasing influence of money in politics, and specifically money in judicial elections.
So, yeah, these judicial races are much more politicized these days and are attracting a great deal more money. But let me play devil's advocate for
you. Sure.
We certainly are trying to reach out to people who are on the opposite side of this issue as of the day that we're sitting here, so far without success, but we're going to keep trying. But I will take their position for a moment. I'll say, look, this is a democracy, a representative democracy. This is an election. And though, yes, certainly judicial qualifications are important, it's also important to know what a judicial philosophy is of somebody. I want to know whether Penny White's a Republican or whether she's a Democrat. I want to know whether philosophically she supports the death penalty or not. So I want to ask a lot of those questions. And if I disagree with her, by golly, I want to go out and I want to oppose her reelection, whether it's a retention election or whether I want to support a candidate in an opposed election. What's wrong with that?
I think at its core, it is founded upon the premise that all three branches of government are intended to be majoritarian and representative. B, big words, but those are bigger words than I usually use. I think at its core, it anticipates that the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch should be controlled by majority rule. What the majority wants, we get. And that we put people in each of those positions to represent our interest. Courts were never intended to be representative bodies. Felix Frankfurter said that, not me.
Very famous justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, often considered one of the smartest ones that we've ever had.
And that simplified just basically means courts are really for the purpose of not representing interest or individuals or issues, but representing, to coin a phrase, the rule of law, of applying the rule of law. Courts are not intended to be majoritarian. In fact, they're counter to that. It is the court that we expect to guard the rights of the minority, to protect, to use a cliche, the little guy against big business or big government, and on the other hand, to when the law requires, protect big business against government or the little guy. So that whole idea that it's a branch of government, it's an elected position, therefore they should all be treated the same, legislative, executive, and gubernatorial, is wrong at its core. Because the judiciary, in no Western civilization, has been for the purpose of either representing or fulfilling majority rule. The person who wants the court to always rule in accord with majority has never been in the minority.
Mm-hmm. Well, we wouldn't have to protect minorities if they were majorities, right? That's why we have individual
And I don't
rights.
Mean minority as a reference to a minority group. I mean any person who finds themselves with a viewpoint different from the mainstream. So, for example, persons whose religion is not necessarily Protestant, persons who choose in some geographic locations of the country to go to church on Saturday instead of Sunday. Mm-hmm. So I'm using minority in the broadest of sense. People who do things differently from the way the majority of people do things, or who believe things differently from the majority of people. That's why we have courts, to assure that the rule of law applies equally to all folks, regardless of their station or status in life.
So, in other words, judges are special.
Well, it sounds trite, but yes.
I mean, seriously, you elect a representative in your legislature to go out and pass laws that you want.
That's right.
You elect your governor to execute them in ways that you want. But judges are supposed to simply apply the law as best they can, without some particular mandate to do this or that.
And in the huge, huge percentage of cases, the overwhelming number of cases, because when we talk about courts, we're not just talking about those 9 people sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court, or even those 5 sitting on the Tennessee Supreme Court. We're talking about every justice of the peace, every general sessions judge, every circuit judge. The huge number of cases decided by judges do not raise policy issues. They simply require the judge to take a law that's been passed and apply it to a set of circumstances. So these insignia, these donkeys and elephants and R's and D's mean nothing in the huge majority of cases that are being decided by our courts.
There's not a lot of politics in a standard contract dispute between the ABC Corporation and the XYZ Corporation, or in a divorce case, typically. Okay, I get what you're saying, but again, I'm gonna take the other side for just a moment here and say, okay, even granting that, there are those big cases with the big policy overtones, and it really does matter whether you've got a relatively liberal judicial philosophy or a relatively conservative one, and we see that at the Supreme Court level. I mean, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas are going to typically rule one way on those big social issues, and Justice Breyer or Justice Kagan are typically going to rule the other way. So is there no role at all for judicial philosophy and for the voters to weigh in on that? Should it be all merit? Should we just ignore the political philosophies of the candidates?
Well, I mean, I think it is a harder question when you talk about the United States Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I think it is what should be a determining factor with regard to those justices should have no effect over the selection of judges at all the other levels. And I mean, I would add that we claim, Chief Justice Rehnquist called the independence of the American judiciary the crown jewel of our society. You know, Stuart, you probably know this. Today is the anniversary of the day the Declaration of Independence was read.
Ah, the public reading.
Yes, yes. And in that document, that beautiful document that we celebrate today and celebrated back on the 4th, there's a list of grievances against the king. Mm-hmm. And the 7th one, I think, says this: he has made judges dependent on his will alone. So I like to say it this way. In the top 10 among the reasons the people left England and came to America and died was to establish a judiciary that is independent of the other branches. And we did that in our Constitution. We stated it as a reason for forming a new country, and then we implemented it in our Constitution. So I harbor the belief that when folks take an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and they are getting ready to become a judge, even a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, that they have sworn and will uphold the independence of the judiciary, which will include ruling in accord with the rule of law. Human nature, judicial philosophy has to come into effect or has to come into consideration at those high levels. But if we really believe that the only thing that matters is judicial philosophy, you and I need to find another job, because we're misleading generations of lawyers who think that if we train them correctly, they can go out and advocate, and based upon their good advocacy and their good knowledge of the law, they can help a court reach the right decision. If the only thing that matters is judicial philosophy, we need to shut down.
Yeah, well, I see your point there, Penny. I see your point. We have a current controversy here in Tennessee involving, oh my gosh, something that happened to you all those years ago. That is, we have three justices of the court who are up for retention, and there is a great deal of opposition to their retention. Now, my understanding is that our lieutenant governor, Mr. Ramsey, is leading the charge in that regard. And once again, we've made repeated requests to Lieutenant Governor Ramsey and asked him if he could be on the show. We've, at least as of this moment, have not heard back from him. I hope that that'll change by the time the show's broadcast. But my understanding is that he has decided that those three must go. And he has got a variety of reasons for that. And he's actively campaigning against it. Do you have any opinion on this issue?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I mean, obviously, I don't mean that as a hesitancy. I mean that as, how are we going to fit all my opinions in the time we have remaining? Well, you know, I think what people need to know first is that it's not that he's targeted three. It's just that we only have three on the ballot again. Mm-hmm. So I like to say there's a lot has changed, but very much has stayed the same.
So he just got bad timing, just
That's
like
right.
You did. Okay.
So because we have two new justices who've been appointed by Governor Haslam, who will be sworn in on September 1st. So they're not on the ballot, only the three. Between those three, there's, gosh, probably 75, 80 years of judicial experience. I think the movement to not retain them has absolutely nothing to do with the quality of the Tennessee Supreme Court, with the quality of justice in the state of Tennessee, with the quality of the justices, and has everything to do with an attempt to bully, intimidate, and control the highest court in the state. And that's a mouthful, but that's the way I feel. There will be an effort to make the public believe that the justices have done something wrong. They will cherry pick some cases. They will probably mislead the public about those cases. and they will try to scare the public or anger the public so that they think that their quality of life will be so improved if they just remove these three justices. When in reality, our Supreme Court is more conservative than liberal. Its decisions are moderate at best. It is respected throughout the nation. Its members have a wealth of experience. And, you know, ask the liberal lawyers in the state of Tennessee, and they'll tell you that the court, if anything, is way too conservative. So none of the information that is likely to come out in attack of these justices will tell the whole picture. And I predict that much of it will be misleading. You know, some of us have gotten a list of some of the cases that the lieutenant governor seems to be complaining about. And, you know, it's almost comical.
He's been making presentations around the state, right? So this is not a secret or anything.
No.
He's been out.
Oh, no, no.
What are some
right.
of the points he's been making as far as you understand it?
As I understand it, there are the first concern that he has is that the attorney general in the state of Tennessee is selected by the Supreme Court.
That's a constitutional issue.
It's a Tennessee constitutional requirement. So his beef should be with those guys back in 1700 who wrote the Tennessee, 1780 or whatever it was, who wrote this version of the Tennessee Constitution.
Okay,
right?
I don't mean to be taking sides on this political question. I'm simply saying that if that's a criticism, then that is a question of whether the Constitution needs to be amended or not,
right.
of the state. Right?
And the process for beginning an amendment is with the General Assembly. He can start that if that's his concern. I understand his anger with the Attorney General flows from the Attorney General participating in receiving funds for Tennessee citizens from several nationwide class actions. So sometimes businesses get sued, they are ordered to pay a lot of damages for things they've done to consumers. And I understand that the Tennessee Attorney General has accepted some of those damages to distribute to Tennessee citizens.
Okay, so the XYZ Corporation is adjudged to have done something wrong. It's a class action, so they're paying big chunks of money to large numbers of people.
Right.
Some of those people live in Tennessee.
Right.
So the Tennessee Attorney General says, okay, I'm going to take charge of distributing the money
right.
to our Tennessee people. Okay,
right.
That's what is wrong with that, according?
I don't know. I can't explain it. So that's one aspect of the complaint. But the other aspect of the complaint that's come out in some of these presentations by the lieutenant governor has to do with certain cases. I would just, it would take us too long to run through the list of cases, but I would just suggest to the public that they reach out to the internet to actually look at the case if they want to, or to a lawyer friend to have the case explained. But on this list are cases that other courts decided, that were decided by Tennessee courts of appeal, not even decided by the Supreme Court. There's a huge complaint about the slowing down of executions in Tennessee. But the fact behind the sort of slowing down of executions in Tennessee is that Tennessee, like many states, have been unable to get the drug cocktail that is used to kill people now. And that is because the European distributors and some American distributors decided not to supply the drugs for executions. So you just
wait
have
a minute. So some of the opponents, or at least it seems to you, the opponents are saying that our Tennessee Supreme Court is somehow anti-death penalty. There's that issue again that you're so familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
They're anti-death penalty when, in fact, the court has nothing to do with the non-availability of the drugs.
Yeah, and the facts are also that the court has upheld more death sentences. These three justices in particular have upheld more death sentences than any of the previous constitutions of the Tennessee Supreme Court. So the label just doesn't stick.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, you know, so the opposition will, in my opinion, rely upon misrepresentation, factual inaccuracies, and will count on a non-scrupulous public, a non-scrutinizing public, a mm-hmm. public that will just say, well, if it smells, you know, there must be fire because there's smoke. And I just hope and I trust the citizens of Tennessee to look deeper and to ask themselves, why would a member of one branch of government want to control another branch of government? What's wrong with that idea of three separate branches of government that we celebrated in this country?
Is this a Republican-Democrat thing? And Lieutenant Governor Ramsey's a Republican.
I think it is.
Are all three of these justices, had they been in their previous lives, had they been Democrats, or were they appointed by a Democratic governor?
The latter, mm-hmm. and perhaps the former, they were all appointed by a Democratic governor.
Okay. The last time something like this happened that people might remember from their history books on a national level, of course, was the great court packing crisis of the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And that's when Franklin Roosevelt, who was a Democrat in that case, was president, and he was trying to control the Supreme Court, and he proposed a perfectly constitutional change in the makeup of the court. But even members of his own Democratic Party were aghast at his bald-faced attempt to control another branch of government, and they recoiled from it, and ultimately it went nowhere. It sounds like that something like that is happening on a state level here, just as the party labels are reversed in this case.
Yes and yes. There are many outstanding members of the Tennessee Republican Party who oppose Lieutenant Governor Ramsey's attempt. So just like in FDR's own party, their opposition to his court packing plan, there are Republicans in the state of Tennessee, lawyers and non-lawyers, who are on record opposing Lieutenant Governor Ramsey's plan.
All right. Well, I guess the advice you've given then is for voters to simply educate themselves and decide for themselves whether they think these criticisms are legitimate or not. And your expectation is they'll find that they won't be. But I guess that's the only solution then, isn't it?
Well, I think that's one solution. I also think it takes a little bit of sort of, what would we call it, rhetorical questions, the why question. Why would outside money, so the money that's being attracted into the state of Tennessee is national money. It's not money from Tennesseans. It's not grassroots money saying, let's get rid of these justices. It's national money. It's this special organization money. Why would outside money want to come into Tennessee to influence, to change the composition of the courts? What do they expect to receive for it? Why do they want to bully? What are they trying to bully sitting justices? You know, what's the impact of this kind of activity on our courts, on the institution of justice, on our state? And also just a simple question. How will an unstable judiciary impact the place where I live?
A judiciary that changes with each election, as opposed to one where you get good people on there and let them stay?
Yeah. What's the benefit of having judicial experience versus having people who have been selected by folks with an agenda serve as your judges? Why would an elected representative? Why in particular would Lieutenant Governor Ramsey, who was elected to head the legislature, want to have such power over the judiciary? Those are the kinds of questions I hope people are asking.
And those are the sort of questions I hope to be able to ask the Lieutenant Governor myself.
Me
but
too.
We'll just wait and see, won't we? And in the meantime, Penny White, my colleague at UT, professor of law and a former justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court, thank you as always for enlightening us on these important issues.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. And vote!
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Penny White for telling us that very painful but very interesting and enlightening tale. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our production intern is Stefan Almond. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. And hey, before we leave, let me remind you, if you missed any of this fascinating tale, you can find the podcast on iTunes. And I encourage you to get on the internet and do so. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.